Some yawn and say, well, I guess we have to go to church because it's Easter. Some people are like that. I mean, there are times when we old-timers who've been at doing this all our lives can think that on a morning. I have contemplated that many times. Others in every church can go to church on Easter to appease family members. We know that's true. Easter creates in people's lives because Christ is risen. It creates joy. Thank you. Easter is the story of death's defeat and resurrection victory. Easter is a moment given our circumstances to say, new creation, Christ is alive. Thank you. Don't stop. And let me just say, we go through these stages. When Frank and I were talking, a lot of this, Sally, where's Sally? There you are, Sally. There's a part of this sermon that I think I probably wrote specifically for you. I know. I mean it. And you'll know exactly where it's at, okay? I was reading N.T. Wright this week on his massive book on the resurrection. Thank you. And it brought to mind and what Tim Keller said. It was when the book had just come out, and it was not the cancer that took Keller's life, but it was before that. He had had cancer quite a few years before that. And he couldn't do anything, so he was sitting, and he was reading this book. He said, I might as well read this book. It's this huge book. And he's sitting, and he says, you know how when you put money in a machine and you can just hear the pop go and come down, or the money go down? And he says, I finished that book, like 800 pages, and I closed it, and I said, good grief, Jesus really did rise from the dead. Now, did he not believe that before? Yes, he did. But it was like there was this new dropping of assurance that this is true. Easter is a moment given our circumstances to say, new creation, Jesus is alive. Am I and are we, is the church at large, we can think, are we just smoking weed so the mind floats to the clouds of heaven? Is that what we're doing? I want all to understand that in this congregation, whether your coin is up here and it hasn't dropped yet, or it's sort of dropped and you're struggling, I want you to know that you are free to doubt, to question, to walk into the future with others on the same journey. And I want you to know you can walk into the future with me, because the older I get, the more questions I have than answers. How is that for an opening paragraph for Resurrection Sunday? I do believe in the resurrection. There are those among us that have received chunks of money because someone died. Generation wealth is a real thing. Now, I know the family feud wars over antiques and homes and investment accounts when someone dies. When I died, I have it on a picture of my family, and it's my mom's driver's license, and there's a dime and a penny and a dime, and that was my inheritance. That's all she had in her drawer. And they're precious. They're the most precious 21 cents I have. This is what she had. But God provided everything she needed down to the last two dimes and one penny. And 9 years ago, though, we were living in the house we're in now, and I went to the mailbox, and I received a letter from an insurance company. Now, I thought, junk mail. You've seen these things, right? Junk mail. And you rip them up. You don't even look at them. You throw them away. I do that all the time. And I was walking back from the mailbox, and I thought, I'll probably should open it and see what it says. So I opened it. My mom had taken a policy out on me decades ago. And I was told in this letter that I had $4,000 in my name from a life insurance company waiting for me. Now, being skeptical, what would you do? Is it a hoax? A scam? Were they trying to obtain my personal information? You wonder those kinds of things. Yet what if $4,000's just a phone call away? What would you do? Well, I'll tell you what I discovered. I discovered my mom loved me more than my sister because she didn't get us insurance policy. I called, filled out the papers, and I literally received a check in the mail. $4,000. Thanks be to God. I don't rip anything up anymore. When it comes to resurrection, we are all continually in our culture being asked if it is a hoax in our personal mailboxes. Or is it $4,000 just waiting to be received? Have we opened the letter? Have we inquired about the $4,000 resurrection invitation? I want you to know that I keep inquiring and receiving $4,000 of resurrection insurance. I haven't stopped thinking about it. The story before us is wonderful, and I want us to consider it as theorizing, as theologizing, and as tenderness. Theorizing, theologizing, and tenderness. Here we go. Theorizing. I want you to know I don't try to synthesize the four Gospels. Make them all line up with all the details. It's impossible. Each writer had their own purpose and resources. Each is concerned with telling the story of Jesus into specific communities. And so certain things are emphasized. Certain people are there. One angel, one person has. Two angels, another have. I don't worry about those kinds of discrepancies. Mary Magdalene, though, in every gospel, is the one who went to the tomb when it was still dark. She is the only person who all four gospel stories have at the tomb. Mary Magdalene. And we could call her hysterical Mary. It's a ridiculous detail. Why is it a ridiculous detail? All the Gospels have women as the primary witnesses, and she is a woman who was hysterical. She was demonized. She had seven demons in her, we're told, and Jesus got rid of them. Now, I don't know how you frame up demonization. We're told that she was loaded with powers that controlled her. And Jesus healed her. And my guess is her past stained her present. And what I mean by that is who she was past affected people's trust in her in the present. That's often the case. I can say this with confidence about Mary, because even in the second century, there was a guy named Celsus. He was a philosopher, and he hated all things Christian. And he wrote, "But who really saw the resurrection? An hysterical woman, Mary Magdalene." As you admit, he's talking to Christians, perhaps one other person, both deluded by sorcery, or else so wrenched with grief at his failure, Jesus's, that they hallucinated this Jesus rising from the dead by a sort of wishful thinking. That was his view. We are told that when this Mary Magdalene saw the stone rolled away from the tomb's entrance, she ran to tell the disciples the body was stolen. She freaked out. She wasn't telling the disciples, "Jesus is alive. Jesus is raised from the dead." She's not doing that. She doesn't believe that. Someone had taken the dead Jesus. And that's what she deduced from her first tomb experience. She did not expect resurrection. No one was expecting resurrection. It was not the Jewish intellectual framework. We think, the people back then, they all believed in resurrection. They didn't. Some Jews believed resurrection happened at the end of time. But no one in the Jewish world said resurrection happens in the middle of time. Not one. That was not in their intellectual framework. So, Peter and John, the beloved, race to the tomb after Mary tells them. And this is where the word theorizing is found. See, Peter's brain is spinning out of control. And we are told that he bent over, which is really the only way we come to Jesus, by bending. And he bent over and he saw the strips of linen there lying, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. And the cloth was still lying in its place, separated from the linen. Now, Peter right here is reasoning his way through this crazy situation. And we know that because it says he saw. And we think, well, so? Because there's two main words. Well, one main word, blepo, that means seeing. You look, you see, he saw. But that's not the word used here by John. The word here used by John is theorizing. He is going through the theories in his head. He's rational. He's reasoning. What's going on here? So he comes in and he's theorizing. Dead people don't come back to life. First century people knew this just like we do. But why would thieves unwrap a dead body? Why? It would already have probably started to decay some. Think of that. Who wants decayed flesh on their hands? Why take the time to neatly fold all the wrappings and head coverings if you're stealing a body? You want to get in, get what you want, and get out. Do thieves worry about tomb tidiness? I remember when Glenn called one time and we came in and he said, I don't think someone in our church did this, and there was all the stuff off this platform was thrown out and it was just a mess. And sure enough, someone had come in and they didn't care about our tidiness in the church. Can I tell us that checking out a $4,000 life insurance check is nothing compared to checking out the grand story of resurrection? It's not. If the resurrection is true, the historical invasion of God and Jesus to earth, nothing is more important. If we say we don't believe, I want you to know we should have sleepless nights that we could be wrong. Some of the greatest persons and minds in the history of the world would spit at the lack of interest in the biggest question. And some of those don't believe. If we go to sleep each night and say we believe in the resurrection, but it doesn't become the vision of our lives, this new creation, I suggest we're fooling ourselves. It's like saying, I believe in eating healthy. Where'd you eat today? Well, I had breakfast at McDonald's, and I had lunch at Burger King, and then I ate Fruit Loops for dinner. You don't believe. So I'm saying our faith is not just high in the pie in the sky crazy thinking. There is a rationality to it. And we need to keep theorizing about this main event in the Christian faith. Because if this isn't true, let's close the doors and go home. But let's also theologize a bit here. Not just theorize, theologize. John's painting the story of Jesus into the big story of the entire world in his gospel. If I could only take one gospel onto a desert island, it would surely be John's gospel. John's gospel is really the story of Genesis retold. It's the story of Genesis retold. I have a painting in my study that's the grand narrative of a person's life. It's just being retold there. John here is telling the grand story of the world, and it starts, the section, this passage, early on the first day of the week. Stop right there. Stop right there. The first day of the week. John's gospel opens, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh in Jesus and dwelt among us." We know that. And when a writer would say, "in the beginning," we know that they are connecting everything back to the beginning, to the creation story. And this is John's gospel. This is what he's doing. John connects his whole retelling of God's activity in the world to the start of creation. In the beginning, God created. Now, right now, though, on the eighth day, the first day of the week, that would be the eighth day, because Sabbath is Saturday. That's the seventh day. So on the eighth day, new creation is invading. It's starting. Genesis frames up for us in poetic and theological reflection the 7 days of creation. And let me just say, I have never, ever in my life, even though I grew up with it, from the time I was from when I first started thinking about theology, I have never held to a 7-day creation. I have never held to a young earth theory. I see these texts within the context of ancient thought and to specific people. But he's saying, John is saying something specific, and so is Genesis chapter 1, and he's bringing them together. John gives us 7 I am statements. There's 7 days of creation. 7 I am statements. I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the door. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. I am the vine. I am the resurrection. Jesus gives us 7 of those statements. 7 days of creation, 7 I am statements. New creation is beginning. That's what's going on here. And John also gives us 7 signs. 7 signs of new creation, what it's going to be like. He turns water into wine. The official's son is healed. The paralyzed man at the pool is healed. Multiplication of the loaves for the multitude. The man born blind is healed. Lazarus is raised from the dead. And Jesus, the Son of Man, when you see the Son of Man, lifted up. He was lifted up on the cross. The 7 signs. And then on the 8th day, Jesus is resurrected. In John's gospel, the sixth day is Good Friday. The 6th day is Good Friday. And Pilate presents Jesus to the people. And it is here Pilate is profound. And he doesn't even know it. He doesn't get it. He says, "Here is the man. Here is the man." You know how profound that is? On what day of the week in Genesis was man created? The 6th day. Friday. "Here is the man." This is the man who's redeeming the world. This is what I intended for creation. This man right here. And he doesn't know what he's saying. This is when God created man in his own image, male and female. And Pilate says, "Here is the man." Jesus is the Word made flesh, the genuine human that is restoring all humanity to reflect his image. The creation of man, 6th day. New creation is beginning. It is on the 6th day that Jesus is pinned to the cross like an insect is pinned on a junior high science poster board project. And what does John record Jesus' last words were on the 6th day? "It is finished. It is finished." And then he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit. And God said at the end of the 6th day of creation, he saw all that he made and it was very good. It was finished. Jesus, his "it is finished" echoes all the way back to creation's 6th day. And what did God do on the 7th day of creation? Sabbath day. Genesis tells us he napped. He rested. And John, in his gospel story, places Jesus in the tomb, resting on the seventh day. Silent Saturday, yesterday, is a day we should pay much more attention to in the church calendar. Jesus, the God-man, is laid to rest. And we confess in the creeds that Jesus descended into death. This is what the Eastern Church calls the harrowing of hell. He empties hell by pulling its inhabitants out on Silent Saturday. But it's not over. The first day of the week, Sunday, the day the early church switched worship to from the last day of the week to the first day, Saturday was the Sabbath, to Sunday, new creation begins. Jesus is resurrected. Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb in the dark, but finds things aren't as she anticipated. Have we come, let me ask you, have we come to the tomb of Jesus and found things not as we have thought? What were Jesus' words from the cross on the sixth day? He cries out, "It is finished." God is, in that cry, is setting his creation on a new creation trajectory. We are called to not reject creation, but immerse ourselves into creation and the relationship God gives us, new creations in him we are, with where the old is gone and the newness has landed. Because I want to say, the gospel is not about dying and going to heaven. Did you hear that? That's not the gospel. It's not about dying and going to heaven. Oh, sure, we know we will be resurrected people. But Jesus comes so he makes new creations that go into creation and reclaim creation and love the creation of men and women, of animals, of birds, of flowers, of oceans. It is about new creation and the living new creation now out of a resurrection, eighth day resurrection. But I close with talking about tenderness, theorizing, theologizing. But there's tenderness in this text. Mary is weeping. I came up with a phrase doing hospice 10 years. And this was the phrase, tears are the blood of the soul. Tears are the blood of the soul. Let me ask you, when was the last time you wept? Frank would tell you this morning. Doing hospice for 10 years, I was forced to absorb the holy tears of people from all these diverse backgrounds. You name it, I had them as patients. I wrote in my journal after being at the death of a Davenport man. This is what I wrote. 1 second he's present, the next shutdown is completed. The 15-year-old daughter whispers for daddy to come back. Eyes are swollen, makeup lines, cheeks, beautiful pictures of suffering love. Left to question the whys and how comes and pain and make meager attempts to see meaning through the blinding darkness. There was a time every morning I stepped into the shower and I wept like an exhausted and hungry baby. You see, we get uncomfortable around sorrowful emotions. We do. Because we don't know what to say, which is the best thing to do is not to say anything. Mary is at Jesus' tomb and she is weeping. The text says that she was crying, and the next verse records that she wept as she bent over and looked into the tomb. And the next verse records that she wept. Yet I say to us that this resurrection day, that in Mary's tears, God was revealing himself to her. And somehow, and I don't know how, but in our tears and our questions and our struggle, God is revealing himself to us there. Tears are holy. Mary glances into the empty tomb and she sees two angels. There are many angel stories documented throughout history, but I'm not going to try to prove that. But the angels, I believe, are intentionally positioned as Mary weeps. And understand, John's the one who tells us that there's two angels at the tomb. Others are just one. Because he's really connecting this whole thing back. One is seated at the head, and the other at the feet of where Jesus had been laid. Notice the tense of my language here. Jesus is not in the tomb. And John, again, is nudging us back to the Old Testament. The Ark of the Covenant had angels, one at the one side, another at the other side, and their wings covered the mercy seat. The sacrifice where God's love in Christ happened. New creation had begun here because Jesus wasn't there. The sacrifice has risen. The axis of the world has tilted in a different direction because it is finished. Tears cloud Mary's eyes, and she turns from the tomb and runs into the gardener. Ah, don't run past the gardener. It is Jesus, but Mary doesn't see it that way. She thinks it's the landscaper of the flowers and the trees, and the person that trims around gravestones and plants flowers to honor the dead. Don't let Jesus the gardener, though, go past your imagination, because in Genesis 2, back to the creation story, we're told God planted a garden in the east, in Eden. God the gardener. Jesus is thought to be the gardener on Resurrection Day. What's God doing? God is in Christ reclaiming his world in Gardener Jesus. New creation is beginning. And I love the fact that the garden in Genesis is in the east. Why? Because the sun, S-U-N, and the sun, S-O-N, rises in the east. Jesus rose at sunrise. I want to tell you, please bury me when I die with my head pointing west, so that when resurrection comes at the end of time, I will sit up and be looking to the east where my resurrection comes from. I want to be Reepicheep. Lewis, in his wonderful book, my favorite book of the Narnia Chronicles, Reepicheep's my hero. This little mouse, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I want to set sail east to Eden and its gardener. And I want you to know, if the ship sinks, I will paddle on a floating board from the ship. And I want you to know, if that board disintegrates, I will swim with my feet in my hands. And I want you to know, if I have not yet arrived in the gardener's eastern paradise, I will sink to the bottom of the ocean with my big fat basset nose pointing east. The sun is rising, and Mary doesn't know it is Jesus, but he calls her by name. So tender. And he doesn't call her Mary. You don't see this because it gets translated wrong so often. Mary is her kind of contemporary name. On Katie Johnson's death certificate will be the name Katrina Johnson. You can start calling Katie Katrina. But Jesus calls Mary Miriam. Miriam. It was her given name at birth. It is the name given by parents in the joy of new life. It is her identity. And Jesus doesn't say it like a parent frustrated out with an out-of-control child. Like, Katrina Allstadt, because I know Kathleen talked to you like that when you were growing up. No, Jesus says it is in a tender, pulling toward himself love. Miriam hears her name roll off of Jesus' lips, and she grabs him. And so, here's my final question. Have we grabbed Jesus with a Miriam love because we have heard Jesus call us by our name. And this is what I can promise all of us here. Jesus is calling you by name. Gently, tenderly, he's saying, you're my daughter. You're my son. I'm your brother. That's the question. Have we grabbed Jesus with a Miriam love because we have heard Jesus call us by our name? In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.